So a few months ago, I am reading a novel by James Salter, one of our leading literary lights for the past half century. And in the middle of a novel about something very different, he dropped a joke. I'm always on the lookout for jokes. So here he goes. A Hungarian count and his wife have a boy who's growing out of his teenage years and becoming a young man, and his wife says to him, says to her husband, "You know, I think it's time that you taught our son about the birds and the bees." And he says, "Really?" And she goes, "Yeah, I think so, it's time." So he says, "Very well." The next morning, takes his son out for a walk. And he says to him, "My child, do you see those women over there who are washing clothes by the river?" And his son says, "Yes, father, I do." And he says, "My son, do you remember what we did with those women yesterday?" He says, "Yes, father, I do." And he says, "My son, birds and bees do that as well." Now that disparity in the way you teach your child about certain things not only exists between couples, but it's a fault line that runs down society. It happens, by the way, in the Tanakh, in the Bible, when an angel comes to Manoah, who is the father of Samson, and tells him that he is about to have a son. And he says to the angel, "Ma na'aseh le'na'ar hayulad," what shall we do with this child who is about to be born to us? And everyone who has had a child, or who has thought about having a child, knows that question. What do you do? When people say that children come with no instruction manual, what they mean is that you can't tell, no matter how much advice you're given, what you should or shouldn't say or should or shouldn't do, because society changes, children are individuals, parents are imperfect, and the whole thing is a mess. And one thing that we see today that is increasingly true and influences the way that we raise our children, whether we want to or not, is the disillusion that is the theme of society. There was a time when sports heroes were sports heroes, and we didn't wait to hear what charges they would be brought up on in the off-season. There was a time when politicians were thought of as people who were essentially doing the public good. But now, just the other night, I saw Matt Bai, who's one of our leading political journalists, on an interview with Charlie Rose, and he said, "The high point of a political journalist's career is when he takes down a candidate." Now think about what that means. It means that the people who are most skilled and most admired in reporting on public figures are the people who can find out bad things about them. And returning to the birds and the bees, I don't have to tell you how often we find out about the private pictures of this or that celebrity that have been put online to diminish and humiliate them, because there is no private space anymore. On social media, snark and insult and anger predominate, and ideals are thought of as being gullible, not being visionary. If you've had the misfortune lately of watching our local news, and by our local news, I don't mean specifically ours, I mean anywhere in the country, you will see that it always begins with four or five terrible stories. And that's not the fault of local news. Obviously, that's what people tune in to see. And international news is much the same. It could be a plague. It could be a virus. It could be a fanatical group doing terrible things. But whatever it is, the fact that more people in America get their news from comedy shows, and comedy is about puncturing ideals, tells you that we're raising our children in an atmosphere that will make them cynical. Unless we counteract it. And they learn, amidst this relentless parade of scandal, that nobility is a facade, and the only thing you can do in this wolfish world is you have to watch out for yourself. You have to make sure that you make a good living, and that you're secure, and that you're safe. And that, of course, is the end of all things and the intention of all things. And so, when you read about college, it's always, what major will make you enough money so that you can be comfortable? I thought about all this in part because, as you all know, or at least almost all of you know, I spent the last couple of years preoccupied with King David. And while I was writing that book on David, I saw here was someone who would not have lasted 5 minutes in a contemporary news cycle. He did a lot of bad things. And the Torah is unsparing in talking about the bad things that David did. It's not a cover-up. There are no rose-colored glasses in talking about the heroes of our people. It records in detail everything. But it also talks about his nobility. Yes, he was a warrior. But he also wrote songs and psalms. And listened. And loved. David wasn't a perfect person. But unlike the tendency today, the Torah doesn't assume that your worst characteristic is what defines you. It knows that people are complex. And so this same David, whom we've seen mistreating other people, when his own child is revolting against him and he walks weeping, running away from the Jerusalem that he has built, it stirs our hearts because we know that there are lots of sides to people. And you can be noble and still flawed. And you can be idealistic and imperfect. And then in contrast to what we see day after day after day, there are a lot of people in this world, in public service and elsewhere, who really do try to do good. The most striking thing to me about the huge concern over the Ebola virus hasn't been the fact that the virus is here or there or is breaking out, but the fact that there are so many aid workers literally willing to risk their lives for nothing. Not only to help the patients, but to cover the outbreak. The reporters are as heroic as the aid workers. But they don't get the same press. Nobody says the pinnacle of being a reporter is to cover a plague-ridden area. No, it's to take down a candidate. That's the pinnacle. And so I worry. I worry about what we're teaching our children and what we tell them to value, as though the only thing that is worthwhile in this world is to go into finance or real estate or something that will make you money. Or, if we're trying to be idealistic, we'll show them that speech that Steve Jobs gave that went viral all around the internet that says, what must you do? You must do something you love. And we feel so good about telling our kids to do something that they love. But you know why Steve Jobs could do something that he loved? Because there were thousands and thousands of people on assembly lines who put together the motherboards for the computers so that he could design them and love them. Because in order to have a world that works, you can't only do what you love, you have to sometimes do what is needed. And I worry that we teach our children to take care of themselves, but we don't teach them not only to love other things, things that won't make you a fortune, art and music and poetry and Torah, but also that we teach them passion, but we don't teach them duty. We don't teach them mitzvah. The idea of mitzvah is to do what someone else needs, not only what you love. There are a lot of people in this world who are doing great good, who fortunately didn't do what they loved. They went into medicine because they didn't have a curveball. Or because they couldn't make it on the basketball court, they ended up being aid workers. In other words, sometimes you are driven to goodness not because it is the thing that is easiest or that you most love, but because there is a need in the world and you see it and you wish to do it. I don't know if we teach our kids that. I don't know if we know it ourselves. I walked by the Sova pantry outside, where for the past several days we've had a couple of cans and people have sat there from 7 in the morning until 3 or 4 in the afternoon with trash cans waiting for people to come by and deposit food. There was very little food there. We've been announcing it every Shabbat, but I know it's a pain to have to load your car up with food and bring it by the synagogue and dump it in. It's a pain. But that's what we're supposed to be doing. That's what mitzvah is. That's what we're supposed to be teaching our children. That some things you do because the world needs you. Some things you give because you're able to give them. And you don't only go into this life to do what you love. You go into this life to love. You may have noticed when we said the Shema, this is the only day of the year, according to traditional Jewish practice, when you say the line right after the Shema, Baruch Shem. The rest of the year, you say the Shema, and then in quiet tones, silently, you say Baruch Shem Kvod Malchuto Le'olam Va'ed. And perhaps you haven't wondered why you say it aloud on Yom Kippur, but I will tell you anyway. The Shema is from Deuteronomy, and Baruch Shem is inserted. It's not in the Torah text. And therefore, since the V'ahavta, which is the next part, comes right after, the rabbis inserted the line, but they didn't want to make a break in the text, in the Torah text, so they said, you can say it, but you say it quietly. And Moses speaks that line, the Shema, in the Torah to the entire people. But the rabbis tell a story about where Baruch Shem came from that is much more intimate. They say the one other time that Israel spoke that line, Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad, listen Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one, is when Jacob was dying. And remember, Jacob's other name was Israel. And as he was dying, he had his children gathered around him. And he was afraid that the tradition that he and his father Isaac and his grandfather Abraham and his grandmother Sarah had brought into the world, it was going to disappear. Because now his family was in Egypt and it would all be gone. And so his children gathered around him and they said, Shema Yisrael, listen Israel. Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. We want to affirm to you that the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And their dying father looked at them and said, Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuto L'Olam Va'ed. Bless God, who has enabled you to see what it is that I wanted you to see in this world. To take on the sense of obligation that I thought you had lost. And so on Yom Kippur, when we are God's children, more than any other time, we say back to God, Baruch Shem. We say it out loud, just as our ancestors said it to Israel. In our world, with our advantages, it is very easy to teach our children that they should be comfortable and they should be kind and they should have a good life. It's harder to teach them that they should be visionary and they should be driven and they should believe in mitzvah. But we all know that that's what got us here. If you think that your great-great-grandparents and my great-great-grandparents did only what they love, then you know nothing about Jewish history. They did what they thought the world needed and they needed to get us here. How do I sum this up? The best way to sum it up, unsurprisingly, is with a Hasidic story. So the story is told of the Baal Shem Tov, the founder of Hasidism, that one of his Hasidim came to him one day and said, you know what I want more than anything in the world? I want what we all pray for, but we don't get to do. I want to see Eliyahu Hanavi. I want to see Elijah the prophet. You are the Baal Shem Tov. You are the great master. Can you do that for me? And the Baal Shem Tov said, yes, I can. And I will. I will tell you how to do it. He said, Rosh Hashanah is coming. There is a house in the forest of very pious Jews. They're poor. They have nothing to eat, nothing to drink, but they are filled with the Spirit of God. If you go on Rosh Hashanah and you bring them food and you bring them wine for Kiddush and you bring them enough to eat and drink for the holiday and you stay with them and celebrate with them, you'll see Eliyahu. So he eagerly did that. He gathered up all the food and he brought it to the house and he fed the children and he fed the couple and they had a beautiful Rosh Hashanah. At the end of Rosh Hashanah, they said Havdalah, in which you pray for Eliyahu and nothing. So he went back to the Baal Shem Tov and he said, I did what you said, nothing happened. The Baal Shem Tov said, no, you don't get it in one try. He said, now's the 10 days of repentance. Each day bring them a little something, and then on Yom Kippur, you bring them right before Yom Kippur a feast so that they can make it through the fast, and then you will see at the end of Yom Kippur, Eliyahu. So he did. Every day in the 10 days of repentance, he brought them a little food, and then right before Yom Kippur, he showed up at the house laden with food and fed them all, and they fasted through Yom Kippur and prayed, and they said Havdalah and prayed for Eliyahu at the end of Yom Kippur and nothing. And he went back to the Baal Shem Tov and he said, I did exactly what you said. And I didn't see Eliyahu. And the Baal Shem Tov said, I know. I didn't intend you to. He said, what do you mean? He said, I didn't want you to see Elijah. I wanted you to be Elijah. That's the lesson. The lesson that we can teach our children is to be Elijah. They have so much, so many gifts. We have given them, as we have been given, wonderful things. But it's not only for them. Teach them to go out into the world, to do good, to be good, to spread some of what we have been lucky enough to give them to others. Teach them that even though they may not see Elijah, each of them can be Elijah. And if we teach that to our children, then maybe, as often happens, they will turn around and teach it to us.